We'll begin with, as we said, Leah and Yaakov. We'll begin with the Medrash, which Nechama Leibowitz cites in her Iyunim to Sefer Bereishis. And she quotes a Medrash which clearly takes the view that Yaakov Avinu is being punished for his cheating Yitzchak. In general, there are two ways of looking at the whole story with Yaakov and Rivka and Yitzchak. One, definitely the majority view in the Rishonim, and most of them of Harshim, looks at this as a positive. It was a necessary step. Yitzchak had to be deceived. It was going to be far too dangerous to allow Esav the power over Yaakov Avinu. And come what may, unfortunately, Yitzchak has been either deceived or deluded, or he's excessively optimistic, however we understand his relationship with Esav. But something has to be done no matter what. And therefore, in a heroic action of sacrifice and risk, Rivka and Yaakov do what needs to be done to obtain the bracha. There is, however, another view which looks at the decision that Rivka and Yaakov make critically, that it was not a justifiable course of action. It was a mistake, despite maybe the immense pressure, the immense stakes which were out there. And the major piece which this has to benefit it is that if you look at the rest of Sefer Bereishis, there does seem to be an awful lot of what seems suspiciously like Mida Keneged Mida, that Yaakov Avinu suffers in the end of Sefer Bereishis, right? All of a sudden, he's being deceived by his children. He's being deceived by Lavan. He doesn't even seem to really benefit from the brachos, which he ostensibly gets in Parshas Toldos. The Ramban, which we'll probably talk about later tonight, demonstrates that Yaakov's whole strategy in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach is to emphasize for Esav, yeah, maybe I got the bracha, but look, you're the master, I'm the servant, I'm serving you. So one medrash that she cites, which clearly takes this approach, that she writes, views Yaakov as being punished, says the following. It's an amazing medrash, right? So let's read it inside. I'll make it a little bigger because it's a little bit small over here. So the medrash says, "Kol ha'layla haisa osa atzma karachal." So the whole night long, says the medrash, Leah pretended to be Rachel. Right, so many times when we talk about the story of Rachel and Leah and the wedding and the swap, we focus, oh, it was so nice. Rachel gave Leah the signs that Leah wouldn't be embarrassed. But what did Leah herself actually do? You know, she does have to go ahead and deceive Yaakov. So the Medrash says she actively deceived Yaakov. She pretends to be Rachel. Then Kevan Shamad Baboker, says the Medrash. By the way, this is the Medrash Tanchuma. So in the morning, Hinehi Leah. So the Torah said, all right, surprise, it wasn't Rachel, it was Leah. So what was the conversation that happened after that? We can imagine it may have been a little bit on the awkward side. So Amar La Bas Haramai, you daughter of the trickster, Lama Remis Osi, how could you deceive? Why did you deceive me? Right in the psukim, that's the charge that Yaakov levels against Lavan. Remember we saw that last week, right? Yaakov says Lama Remisini, which we saw was similar to what Shaul says to Michal. But here in the Medrash, Yaakov doesn't say it to Lavan. Yaakov says it to Leah. How could you? How could you deceive me? And I thought you were the tzaddikus, your father. I understand. What about you? What does she respond? Amra lo, ve'ata lama rimisa avicha. Oh, yeah, why did you deceive your father? Okay, why did you deceive your father? Because amra lacha ha'ata ze b'ni Esav. You said, is this you, my son Esav? Amarto lo anochi Esav b'charecha. You pretended to be the firstborn Esav. Ba'ata Omer Lama Rimisini. And now you dare, Yaakov, you dare accuse me? How could I deceive you? I'm just doing the same thing you did. I'm just taking a page out of the Yaakov Avinu playbook. Davicha, lo amar alecha, ba'chicha bermerma. Didn't your father tell Esav that his brother, i.e. you, Yaakov, came instead of you in an act of deception? So that's the Medrash Tanchuma, which she quotes. And she writes very nicely. Our sages mostly take the side of Yaakov against Lavan, still detect the workings of strict justice. And it doesn't matter. Yaakov could be the greatest of the great, no respecter of persons, in what had befallen Jacob. The Medrash Tanchuma here is seeing Yaakov being punished for what he did. He deceives Yitzchak, and now he gets the exact same treatment. We can do what this Medrash, though, is. I want to take it kind of one step further and then show another strain of thought in Chazal, which also sees a parallel between the activities of Yaakov and Leah, but is not necessarily siloed into the view that looks at this in a critical of Yaakov and Rivka lens. Okay, the first main point to deepen the the poignancy of this, really, which boosts the view, I think, of the Medrash Tanhuma, is the view of what seems to be really the majority of, or at least a substantial percentage of the Mefarshim, in understanding that funny pasuk about Leah, that Enei Leah Rakos. So let's remember, the Torah tells us that Lavan has two daughters. One, the older one is Leah, the younger one is Rachel. And the Torah tells us, very, very funny, Leah's eyes were Rakot. V'Rachel, I saw you fast, sorry, fast, Mara, and Rachel was beautiful. So you know the classic Rashi who explains why are Leah's eyes Rakot, why are they soft, whatever exactly soft means, because she was crying because she was destined to marry Esav. We'll come back to that Rashi in a couple of minutes. What does it mean that they were soft? So some of the Mefarshim, really the Rashbam takes this approach, and others as well, argue that Rakos means it's a form of beauty. Leah had beautiful eyes. She had soft and beautiful eyes. You look, the Dat Mikra takes this approach, for example, and he sends you to Shir HaShirim, where Hashem describes the beauty of the eyes of Bnei Yisrael. So if that's the case, the Pasuk is saying that Rachel may have been the more beautiful of the two sisters, but at least Leah also had beautiful eyes. Okay, that's one major view. However, a bunch of the Mefarshim will see some of the advantages that this interpretation has. Say, no, read it in a completely different way. Says the Ibn Ezra, what does Rakot mean? Kimashma'o. It means what it sounds like it means. The straightforward read. What does that mean? Soft means sensitive. The Ramban, B'chor Shor, others are all going to say this. It means that Leah's eyes were sensitive. Leah's eyes were weak. We can't skip this. Ibn Ezra's a great dig. You know, everyone saw I read Ibn Ezra, you're in for a treat, because he quotes one of the Karaites, and then he always comes up with exceptionally creative insults. So he quotes this Karaite Ben Ephraim. Ben Ephraim suggested, you know, before the modern documentary hypothesis scholars came around and said that we just have a completely corrupted text of the Torah, God forbid. So Ben Ephraim was ahead of the curve on that one. So he said, there's a defect in the text. Shehu chaser aleph, v'ta'amo arukot. Really, the Torah should be saying, or I don't know what he means, it's a defect in the text, but he means the word means is Leah's eyes were long. Leah had long eyes. Hey, take that for what it's worth. Then what does Ibn Ezra do? He says, the who haya chaser aleph. The Finner explains. What does it mean? He was missing an aleph. What does it mean? Ibn Ezra is telling us it's not that the Torah is missing an aleph. Ben Ephraim is missing an aleph. You take the aleph out of Ben Ephraim, and what are you left with? He's a Ben Purim. He's a clown, right? He's a Purim guy. There's this jester who's up there who's giving interpretations that don't exist. Says the Ibn Ezra, the straightforward interpretation is that Leah had soft, weak, sensitive eyes. The Ramban says the exact same thing. The Ramban says this explains why Rachel is going out to be the shepherd. Why is Leah at home? Leah is the older sister. I understand, he says. I understand that Lavan is not very successful financially at the beginning of the parsha before Yaakov enters the picture. I understand he doesn't have any workers. He just has to use his daughters as shepherds. And he seems to only have enough shepherds and only one daughter needs to go out with them. But why Rachel? Why not Leah? So says the Ramban, probably because Ulai Bavur ki inei Leah Rakot, Yashemesh Manzikla. She couldn't go out. She had eyes that were too sensitive. She couldn't go out in the sun. That outdoors demanding lifestyle was not something that her weak eyes could handle. The Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor from Ashkenaz says the exact same thing. He has an interesting interpretation, by the way. He just says the reason why the Torah is telling us this is we should know. One might think that, the Torah is telling us that Rachel was beautiful. God forbid you'd think that Leah was ugly. And so the Torah says, no, Leah wasn't ugly at all. She had no defect whatsoever, except the Torah tells us the one physical defect that Leah had, she was otherwise beautiful, the one defect she had, rak she'ina rakot, she just had sensitive eyes, v'ksholachas negen haruach kashela, her eyes which couldn't stand the wind. Okay, so she has weak eyes, they can't stand the outdoors, the sun, the wind, etc. But what's the key point, how to link it back to this medrash, is that it is not only, and I think for sure this is what the Tanhuma has in mind, it's not only we see this parallel between the deception of Yitzchak, who is deceived by Rivka and Yaakov into thinking that the younger sibling is the older sibling. Here it's vice versa, right? Here Yaakov is going to be tricked, but he's tricked by Leah, who's weak of eyesight. In other words, it's like Yitzchak's revenge almost. You know what I mean? Like it's the one who was basically blind, the one with weak eyes, now turns the tables and deceives Yaakov. So everything is flipped. Everything is reversed. Here it's the older sibling pretending to be the younger sibling. Here it is the one who has good eyesight who is being deceived by the one who cannot see. It's happening at night, so everyone is functionally blind in this situation. This may be a piece which the Tanhuma is picking up on, right? A link in the Psukim themselves, which leads to this view. However, what does Rashi do? What is the point of the Medrash which Rashi quotes, which says that Leah was crying because she was supposed to marry Esav? We just read it as kids. We're taught, okay, Leah was supposed to marry Esav, and she was very sad, and that explains why she's happy to marry Yaakov instead. But there's something much deeper going on over here, which is what Rashi's Medrash is doing, is saying Leah finds herself in the exact same situation Yaakov Avinu was in two prakim ago. Parak Chav Zayin. Why? What was the bracha which Yaakov needs to steal? That one brother is going to serve the other brother. If Esav gets the bracha, the plan is going to be that Yaakov will serve Esav. And so Yaakov has to do whatever he needs to. It may be tough in the moment. It's not fun putting on goat skins and having to deceive your own father, especially when your trademark element is MS and you're thoroughly a man of integrity. But Yaakov does what he needs to do. His mother is right. He has to get the bracha no matter what. We can't have a situation where he is serving Esav. What this Medrash that Rashi is quoting here is doing is saying Leah finds herself in the exact same situation. She is going to be destined to serve Esav unless she pulls off the deception, just like Yaakov. So you may struggle for a minute when you read the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, and you may say, okay, I understand the behavior of Lavan in the story. I understand why he would do the deception. I understand the behavior of Rachel. I understand sacrificing herself in favor of her older sister. The one who we never really think about to try to explain is how can Leah Imenu be on board for deceiving Yaakov? And then how can Leah have the gall to expect Yaakov to love her and for her to be an accessible one of the Imahos and for her to be on par with Rachel, who was supposed to be married all along? And what this Medrash is saying is you have to realize that she just finds herself in the exact same situation that Yaakov is in. And it opens up a very, very difficult question. What do you do when you find yourself in this situation where it's easy for us to say that the ends never justify the means, but sometimes in life, maybe they do. And that seems to be the malchokas that these two midrashim are wrestling with. Do we look at the behavior of Yaakov and Rivka critically? And then we have the Medrash, which is saying, Leah looks at him and says, look, what I just did is no different from what you did. And what was good for the goose is good for the gander. But the other way to look at it, though, is to say, no, maybe the ends did justify the means. And just like Yaakov and Rivka realized they did what they needed to do, and hopefully Yitzchak will be able to realize that that was correct in due course and good time. And if you do have someone of unimpeachable integrity, they'll realize that after the fact. Then Leah finds herself having the exact same issue that she struggles with two prakim later. That is the view which is being pushed by the Medrash over here. So it's not just to explain the local words of the text, but these are two different ways of looking at the parallel between Leah and Yaakov, which are really belie two fundamentally different ways of looking at the whole story. Okay, I thought it was worth spending like 15 minutes or so on that because it just really unlocks a lot of the Leah and Yaakov relationships. Now, though, let's go back to Parshas V'yishlach, main story over here. I'm very excited about this. So we have this Rashi. I've been like waiting to do this one like since we began the Shir Sim. So we know the Rashi. It's the weirdest thing in the world, right? So the Torah tells us that, there we go, I can see. So it's that night, and Yaakov takes his wives, he takes the Shvachos, he takes his 11 children, and he crosses the Yabok River. So Rashi asks a reasonable question. So Rashi says, 11 children, there are 12. Yeah, Binyamin hasn't been born yet, but Dina's been born. So Rashi asks, V'dina heichan haisa? Where was Dina? So Rashi says, Nasna b'teva v'nal b'fana. So he put her in a box, locked it up. Shelo yitain ba Esav einav. Said Esav would not look at Dina. And the Medrash and the Rashi quotes, criticizes Yaakov for this. Lachein ne'enash Yaakov, because he withheld Dina from his brother, maybe she would have made him a Baal Tshuva. Shaman ame achiv, shema tach tziren lemutav. Instead of marrying Esav, she marries, she ends up together with Shechem. Where is this coming from? Where on earth is this? What does this even mean? So I can understand on a very, very narrow level, right? Like, okay, so I have a problem. Dina is missing in the pasuk. So this explains where Dina was. We know that Dina is going to be in big trouble in a couple of prakam later. But where are we getting this idea that Dina could have turned Esav around? Didn't we say like 2 minutes ago that Leah was the other Rashi, the other Rashi who said that Leah was crying for her whole childhood because she was dreading the prospect of marrying Esav? That I understand. I understand why you'd be crying. You're going to marry Esav. It's not going to go well. You know, it's not going to be. He's not going to be husband of the year. Why all of a sudden now, in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, one parsha later, is Rashi saying it was the worst thing ever that Yaakov did not allow Dina to marry Esav? What sign do we have that Esav is a potential to be a Baal Tshuva? Rashi in particular happens to be like bends over backwards at every step to emphasize if there's a chance that Rashi has to make Esav look bad, he's going to make Esav look bad. All of a sudden now, we say, Esav could have done Tshuva if only he had married Dina, and Yaakov has punished Dina for not giving that opportunity. Where is it coming from? What? Iota of a hint is there that Esav and Dina have anything to do with each other? What iota of a hint is there that Esav had the potential to do tshuva? What tshuva is there from Esav? He wants to murder his brother, and then he changes his mind, doesn't murder his brother, and he goes on his merry way. We've no. He marries two Kanani women. He notices his parents are troubled by that finally, and so he goes and instead of Rashi points out, instead of actually fixing the problem and divorcing them, he says, okay, I'll keep the Canaanite women I have, but I'll throw a bone to my parents and I'll marry the daughter of Yishmael as well. There's a new tshuva. The end of Rashi in the end of Parshas Vayishlach is going to go through all the names of Esav's family and he's going to show, he's like, wait a second, we're calling this the person's wife. I thought this person was that person's wife and sister. And Rashi is going to show in five or six different places the rampant adultery and incest and everything that's perverse that's happening in the world of Esav. We're getting the idea that all we need to do was just throw Dina into the mix and somehow we'll have tshuva. No tshuva with Shechem, no tshuva with Hamor. It's a very, very difficult Rashi to understand. It seems like it's coming out of nowhere. What are we drawing on to get this idea that Dina could have cured Esau? You think that it's a Medrash that says it. It's a Medrash that says it. You can't blame Rashi, right? Now, at the same time, Rashi is very selective in the Midrashim that he quotes. So he's quoting this for a reason, right? And it can't just be to explain where Dina was. It is a question why Dina isn't mentioned. But to quote-unquote solve that by saying that she had the potential to turn Esav around when we have no hint of any of this is very, very difficult to swallow. I think we're going to show where Chazal are getting this idea from, and the real power and importance of the idea that belies it. The reason why is absolutely imperative for Rashi to cite this matter. So we'll see. We need to familiarize ourselves with Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chaf Hei, which is the chapter when David HaMelech is, once again, he's on the run from Shaul. He's in the wilderness in the area of Shevet Yehudah, and he finds himself with his ragtag army he's put together of no good nicks and runaways and people who are down on their luck, and they end up attracted to David. So he's got 600 men with him, and they're scratching out a living for themselves, unclear how, but they find themselves watching the sheep of a man named Naval HaKarmeli, in one of the very, very prominent members of Shevet Yehudah. An extravagantly wealthy person. If we just spend a couple minutes reading the story, we'll notice a very, very, very clear parallel that the Navi tries to draw. So there's a man who's from Carmel. He's very wealthy. Got a lot of sheep. Sheep are a very prominent piece of story over here. He goes to shear his sheep. He has a wife named Avigail, who's excellent. Pasuk Gimel, we're told that not only is she beautiful, she's also Tovat Seichel, right? She's also excellent intellectually. She's got everything going for her. Just the problem is her husband is a disaster. The man Ha'ish Kasheh V'ra, the man is bad. He's tough. Kalvi can be a reference. It's a double entendre. It probably refers both to his family, that he's from the house of Kalev, but also that he behaves like a dog. So then when David, after having guarded his sheep for many months, finds out that the shearing is happening, the shearing normally in Tanakh is a very exciting occasion, because that's like payday. Because when you shear the sheep, that's when you take them to market, that's when you make a lot of money. So it's a very, very exciting moment when you can shear the sheep. So David sends some messengers to Nabal saying, hey, we just worked for you very hard. Can you throw us a bone here? You know, we work very hard. We protect all your sheep. Can you pay us some money? And Nabal says, absolutely not. Who is this David? I'm not going to pay him a red cent. I should take any of my stuff and give it to him. No way. Okay. So that's the message which David gets. This person, Nabal, who after David guards the sheep for him, he gets stiff. So if we just scratch a little below the surface, we can notice that in these 12 psukim, or 11 psukim really, the Navi, going out to page 3 over here, the Navi is trying to bend over backwards to make us think of Yaakov's unfortunate experience with Lavan when we look at David with Nabal. A number of the modern commentators have pointed this out. This is definitely not my chiddush whatsoever. Both the stories have the shearing of the sheep. We have Lavan going to shear a sheep. We have David going at the time where the sheep are being sheared. The way the Navi describes the loyal guards who are protecting the sheep. So Yaakov tells Lavan, Rami, he says, I worked night and day, right? Genuv si yom, genuv si laila. My time in the day and night was stolen. I was frozen at night. I was burned during the day. And regarding David and his men, we're told the same thing. They were walled for us at night and during the day. It's not in the pasuk I quoted because I'm being a little bit careful in where I break it up. It's pasuk Yudal. I think it's pasuk Yudal, I believe. That's the report. That's going to be the description of David's garden. Whereas we have the salary stiffing. We know that despite the fact that Yaakov works tirelessly for Laban for 20 years, Laban tries as hard as he can to walk away without giving Yaakov a single thing. He manages for 14 years to get work for free because he just gives him his two daughters and he cheats him to get 7 free years. And then he tries time after time after time to change the deal so that he can mess Yaakov over. David finds himself in the same way with Nabal. Nabal, who despite David's loyal work for him, wants to give him absolutely nothing. And there's one more, besides the obvious one, which I see has somehow left off of the source sheet, so I'll just fill it in outside. Both Lavan and Nabal have this very disturbing way of talking, where they love to talk about how everything they have is mine. Right. So Lavan, and really, it's probably my favorite moment of dialogue, honestly, in Sefer Bereishis, is where after Yaakov's epic rant, it's the best we call it, it's an epic rant, when he just lets go 20 years of disgust and contempt and anger. You know, I've been working for you tirelessly. I've been nothing but perfectly for all time. Whenever someone wants to look at what integrity looks like, they're going to look with how Yaakov dealt with Lavan and the sheep. Anything happened, I didn't take a sick day, I didn't take a day off. Anything happened, I paid for it no matter what. And this is how you repay me. What's Lavan's response? It's so perfect. Lavan, completely unmoved. Lavan says to Yaakov, Abanos benosai, the daughters are mine. Abanim banai, the sons are mine. Atzon soni, the sheep are mine. Mekol asher ataro ad lihu. Everything is mine, 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 mine. It may be technically in your bank account, but I look at this as all belonging to me. And Nabal is somebody who talks in the exact same way. He says, I'm going to take lakachti, I'm going to take eslachmi, my bread, my water, astiv chasi, and I take my meat, asher tavachti the gozazai, that I slaughtered for my sheep shearers, and I'm going to give this to other people. Both of these people, so both Lavan and Nabal are people who rob, who cheat. They're all people who are obsessed with saying mine. Okay. The last and most glaring one, which Chazal point out, the name itself of Lavan Nabal, the same letters. They say it's the same even identity. And there's a very, very important idea here. We try to think of, you know, like the epitome of evil. So we can think of murder. We can think of theft. What Lavan and Naval both share in common is the evil, the profound evil of taking advantage of the person who is vulnerable, taking advantage of the worker, which the Torah looks at in a very harsh light. It's not just theft. It's this person worked for you and you steal their rightful wages. The greed and the oppression, right? Oshek, lashok means to oppress. But Rashi points out when the Torah uses it as an avera, it specifically refers to the relationship between the employer and the employee. That's the behavior of Nabal, and that's the behavior of Lavan. Totally abhorrent and reprehensible. Okay, very nice. So David, dedicated, loyal, honest, hardworking David, just like Yaakov Avinu, which is a theme we've seen a little bit before. And when we talk in 2 weeks, we'll try to draw that. We'll try to nail that home in one more big shear. All very comfortable with this, right? We're good. So then we got to read one more pasuk, and we'll read one pasuk, and this is very alarming. So what does Pasuk Gimel say? As soon as David hears the news, right? And David, who remember, the Navi is building up in our minds. Think of Yaakov Avinu when you think about David. Pasuk Gimel, all of a sudden, Torah says, the Navi says, after David is told he's not getting any money from Naval, the Emor David Lanashav, Chagru Ish Escharba, boys, put on your swords. Vayachgru Ish Escharba, Vayarin said, they put on their swords. Vayachgor Gam David Escharba, and David puts on his sword. Vayilu Acharei David Ke Arba Meosnish. 400 men go after to follow David. And what's their plan? To wipe out the household of Naval. Okay. An angry general at the head of 400 men going to wipe out a family. Face up, right? Face up. So in one pasuk, David, who we've been building up, Yaakov, it's Lavan and Yaakov, Lavan the oppressor, Yaakov the victim, David is the victim, Nabal's the oppressor. In one pasuk, the Navi turns the tables as sharply as they could possibly be turned. Where all of a sudden, David has like metamorphosized from the Yaakov Avinu personality to the Esav personality. And Naval has metamorphosized seemingly into the innocent Yaakov. He's going to be wiped out. But it's defensive though, right? And I don't think the Torah ever uses a phrase of girding swords, like it does over here. And I mean, look at the military language here, the repetition. Three times, right? David says, Chigru ish escharbo, right? Gird your swords. Vayachgaru ish escharbo, they gird their swords. Vayachgor gam David escharbo, David girds his sword, right? It's like, it's our military. And then the kicker, right, is the 400 men. Now, it happens to be that this is not the first hint that David may have a streak of Esav in him. When Shmuel is first introduced to David, so the Navi describes to us that he was red and with nice eyes. And the Malbim writes about this, that as a reason why Shmuel was nervous about this being the future king, because on the one hand, he looks very nice and friendly and innocent. At the same time, the red is alarming, because you know what the red can mean. The red can mean somebody who has bloodlust. The red can mean somebody who is willing to kill, which, what? Gets exactly, right? The emotion, the anger, very volatile. There's dangerous potential over here. Basically, there's an Esav streak within David. Those are the two red people we know. Who's the quintessential Admoni until now? The person who literally, the Torah says, called Edom, was Esav. So that streak was there potentially latent within David. And now it bursts out into the forefront as soon as he gets provoked by Naval. And as understandable as anger may be in this situation, Navi is telling us that David is taking this way too far. Okay. So now comes the piece where we can begin to see why Rashi looks at Dina as the potential salvation for Esav. We're going to see that the Esav in Sefer Shmuel, who is David HaMelech is going to be safe. So what happens? So we said the Nabal has this wife, Abigail, this amazing wife, right? She's intellectually outstanding, physically beautiful. We're going to see her emotional intelligence is off the charts. So she's given the message that David's on the warpath with 400 men. And so what does she do? So just look at Pasuk Yedches over here on page number 4. Pasuk Yedches, Torah tells us what she do right away. So she takes a lot of bread, Masayim Lechem, Shnayim Nevlayayin, she takes two bottles of wine, she takes some sheep, she takes some toasted grain, she takes some dried fruits, she takes some figs, and she loads it up on donkeys and sends it ahead of her, a very significant bribe of food that she sends ahead to David and his men. Now, once again, we've seen this playbook before. This is exactly what Yaakov does when he tries to head off Esav, right? Send the huge bribe. Now, it's not the exact same story by any means. We said the Ramban pointed out that Yaakov had a very particular strategy. It wasn't just to placate Esav, but it was to demonstrate that you are the Bechor and I am serving and I'm giving you. I guess maybe Abigail is doing something similar in the sense of, you know, David was upset because he didn't get fed. Well, now I'll try to feed him. But the image of sending of the person who is sending food to the leader of the 400 men, it reinforces the reference, the beginning of Parsha Savayishlah, where we have David once again paralleled with Esav, and now we have Abigail filling the role of Yaakov Avinu. Okay. And then that gets really confirmed when they have their conversation. Abigail comes to David and bows down before him, just like Yaakov Avinu does to Esav. And then if you look at I have on the top here, being Abigail Yaakov. So if you look at the language that Abigail uses and the language that Yaakov uses, we'll notice that they really just do the exact same thing. What I did on the bottom paragraph over here, for Abigail's, for Yaakov's conversation with Esav, is I grayed out the pieces here which come from Esav. So the black and the color, that's all Yaakov, so that you can get a sense of how loaded Yaakov's conversation is with the color terms. I'm just trying to get rid of some of the noise over here. And they have three terms which they both use time and time again, with one kind of important but understandable difference. Their number one idea is to emphasize subservience. That's what Yaakov does, and that's what Abigail does. So look how Abigail, time and time again, how does she call David? My master, Adoni, in the blues. How often do we see Adoni? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like a dozen times in under a dozen psukim. She's saying Adoni, 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 Adoni. Again and again and again, my master, my master, my master. And at the same time, she refers to herself as your maidservant. I'm the maid servant. You're the master. The master. I'm the servant. I'm the man. You're the master. I'm the servant. Over and over and over again. And yet, a third piece Abigail mixes in is she keeps on referencing the Shem Hashem, right? Hashem's name she references also time and time again. Now, what she's trying to do there is she's trying to simultaneously calm David down, right, by emphasizing that she is being submissive. He's the master. She's the servant. Let's calm you down. At the same time, she's mentioning the Shem Hashem to remind David of what his values are and that he should probably not be on the Esav track. He should get back onto the track of HaKol Kol Yaakov. He should get back onto the, you know, track of nonviolence and non-murder. But Yaakov Avinu, when he has his dealings with Esav, he does the exact same thing. All his dialogue with Esav is Adoni Avdecha, Adoni Avdecha. You're the master, I'm the servant. You're the master, I'm the servant. Again and again and again. And invariably, the Shem Hashem leaks in, right, time after time as well. Now, it's interesting, he doesn't use the Shem Yudke Vavke. It's interesting that he uses the Shem Elohim when he's talking with Esav. You know, it makes sense. The name Yudke Vavke does not exactly have the same resonance with Esav that it has with David HaMelech. But the same basic playbook of how to deal with the dangerously angry person, right, is just in the moment trying to calm them down. Abigail is doing exactly what Yaakov does. with the way that she talks to him and with the present that she sends there. Okay. Now, the important thing is that, okay, people can get angry, and you might even have somebody who has a terrible anger streak. The question is, and here's where Esav diverges from Yaakov Avinu, from David, is what do you do with it? So what does David do after? First of all, Abigail successfully stops him, and he blesses her. He says, thank God you stopped me. You calmed me down. I'm not going to commit murder. What happens after Nabal dies? Nabal dies a couple of seconds later. He has a stroke, and that's the end of him. So right away, when David finds out this has happened, so he wants to marry Abigail, right? Now, in the psukim, this is a major piece of Chazal are doing. In the psukim, it might feel a little bit uncomfortable, honestly. Like, well, like the he said Shiva, like the corpse is barely dead and you're marrying his wife. There's nothing wrong with it, per se. There's nothing wrong with it. It does feel, it's a little bit strange. There's a whole piece to discuss there if we were doing Sefer Shmuel, but we're not. We did that 2 years ago. But what the Medrash is doing, though, is by linking Avigail with Dina, saying one very, very basic proposition, saying David is marrying Avigail because he realizes that she was able to keep my danger streak, my Esav streak in check. That's somebody that I want to have around long term. Right? If she was able to do it once, if she was able to get me off of that track in the few psukim earlier, then this is a relationship which is worth pursuing long term. It's for my own benefit. It's for my own spiritual benefit that David is doing that. And I will venture this, the parallels to Yaakov and Lavan and Esav, that's totally out there in the discussion of Sefer Shmuel. I haven't seen this point made, but I'm sure that this is absolutely the pshat in the Medrash. When Chazal are saying that Yaakov should have given Dina to marry Esav, what they're saying is the exact same thing. They're saying Dina could have been the Abigail, just like David has the Esav streak, right? We know that David is kind of, you have the exceptionally talented girl who, by the way, has, or woman, who has the Yaakov Avinu traits, who's able to calm down David. Now, Esav can't marry Yaakov. Esav cannot have Yaakov around him long-term, for many reasons. And Yaakov's also not interested in it. But Yaakov has a daughter. Yaakov has a daughter who presumably shares his genes, who presumably shares his values. Just like the Avigail, who represents Yaakov, is able to marry David and keep the Esav streak in control. So I think Chazal are saying the exact same thing is true about David with Esav and with Dina. So it's a comment which is explaining both what's happening here and say for Shmuel. Why does David marry Abigail? Because he notices that she can keep him in check, and that's important long term. And it also is taking a stance on Esav. Don't give up on Esav. And it's such an important idea, right? Like, yeah, even an Esav who has that danger and no one's shying away from the evil that's operative over there, you can't give up on that. You have to have the infinite patience. But if you have faith in the goodness and the rightness of the Yaakov Avigail worldview, when exposed to that consistently, even somebody like an Esav can come around. Because David HaMelech is able to come around. So if David HaMelech come around, maybe Esav could have come around too. It's such a deep idea. But that's exactly what Yaakov failed to do. He gave up on his brother. We can understand why, but even somebody who seems like they have no hope, you can't give up. You can't give up because look what Avigail is able to do. And I think that there's one more piece in Chazal, which is kind of following up on this a little bit, because if we think about David as somebody who has the Yaakov in him, as we saw with his dealings with Avigail, with Nabal, but also has that Esav streak. So I feel uncomfortable about this, right? Like, is this really the person we want to be the first founding king of Israel? You know, we want someone who's like all Yaakov and no Esav. Like, wouldn't that have been better? So if we think of Abigail as like the essence of Yaakov, so that explains, there's a pasuk and a fascinating gemara. So the pasuk tells us there's only one son we know that Abigail has, David. There's one child, you know? And you'll have to know, like, who is this going to be? Avigail, who's like the greatest of the greats. I mean, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, when it says a king can't marry too many wives, it uses Avigail as the example. It says, even if the wives are on the level of Avigail, you can't marry more than 18 Avigails. So she is the greatest of the great. Well, who's the child? Well, let me see. What's the offspring of Dov and Avigail? Who do we got? We have one man we know about, and we know nothing about him for all intents and purposes. The Navi says, the son was Killa. L'Avigail, Eshes Nava L'Karmeli. Right? Avigail, so she and Dov have the son Killa. Well, we never hear about Killa ever again. That's good. All the rebellions and the whole sordid history of David's family, he's not involved. He's also not involved in politics. You know, we just don't see anything about it. So there's a Gemara in Baba Basra. It may sound familiar. The Gemara says, fascinating idea, there are four people who died because of the snake. Right? In other words, they never sinned. There are four who only died. They never committed a sin in their lives. They only died because the snake condemned all of us to mortality. The Elohim, here are the four. Binyamin ben Yaakov, the Amram Avi Moshe, the Yishai Avi David, the Kilav ben David. Okay, so four people never sinned. Binyamin, Amram, Yishai, David's father, and Kilav, David's son. What's the Gemara getting at over here? So specifically looking at Kilav, this is true of all four, but specifically looking at Kilav, through the Yaakov and Esav lens, explains to us what's going on. All four of these people are perfect. It's true. They also never do anything. What does Kilav do? Kilav doesn't do anything. Yishai, we don't know anything that Yishai does. Amram, what does Amram do in the Pesukim? He marries Yocheved, and that's it. He walks off the stage of history. We never see him do anything again, ever. Binyamin is completely passive. The whole story. We understand why. He's the youngest brother, but he's very passive. But what else do all four of these people share in common? They are very closely associated with people who failed prominently, who failed terribly, and yet accomplished much more. Binyamin, who are the two brothers who are fighting over Binyamin? It's Yehuda and Yosef. Both of whom fail, both of whom mess up, especially Yehuda, but able to turn around and do tshuva and become ultimately the Melech. Amram's son is Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu has his mistakes. For whatever reason, the Torah emphasizes again and again Moshe's betrayal, Moshe's mi'ilah at Mei Meribah. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. And Yishai and Kilav, they're the father and the son of David. David has his mistakes. David has his sins. No question about that. But David accomplishes so much more than both of them. So you may wonder why, like, why did the king have to have the Esav streak? Why can we just have, you know, the pure essence, just have the innocence and the good and nothing else? And the answer is, if that's what you want, then you're going to have Kilav. Kilav, yes, is the son of Avigail in every sense of the word. And Avigail, who's, you know, the essence of Yaakov Avinu, like what Dina could have been, is able to keep David in check. But that's not who the leader is supposed to be, because the leader has to be somebody who also has that Yetzer Hara, who has that darker impulse. What makes him the leader is the ability to transcend it, is the ability to overcome mistakes and the ability to keep it in check. So Kilav is the perfect son, but he's not the perfect king. The perfect king is David, who has his flaws, but is able to recognize those and rectify them by bringing Avigail on board. And I think it's that same exact theme that David that Chazal are getting at with Esav. As bad as you want to make Esav, and yeah, Rashi's going to pile onto him time after time. We're not going to shy away in Parshas Toldos. We're not going to shy away in Parshas Vayetze and Parshas Vayishlach. As bad, and every minute that we make Esav worse, that only makes it more impactful, the faith that we load up into that pasuk in the beginning of Vayishlach. Where I say, yeah, as bad and bad and bad as you make us about to be, remember, even for them, there's hope. Even for them, there was hope. And it is specifically those who have all those troubles, who beneath all that is all of the amazing potential. The higher the challenges are for the person, the more the potential they could be overcome. And David was able to unlock that, thanks to Avigail, thanks to himself for recognizing it, and thanks to Avigail for unlocking it. And that's what Chazal are calling out. And we're looking at Dina and saying, no, it wasn't just yes, it is partially the local read in the pasuk, like where Dina go? There are 11 kids. Dina is not on the list. And we see what happens a couple of prakim later. But it's also looking at the broader framework, looking at Esav in this more sophisticated lens. I think that's a major piece of what's going on. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next week, there's a, I think a tefillah program is happening. So we are not going to meet next week. So Mirtz Hashem will resume in 2 weeks. Parshas Miketz is in 2 weeks, right? So Parshas Miketz, good. So we have three left. Parshas Miketz, we'll talk about Yaakov and David, Mirtz Hashem. We'll talk about Yosef and some of the Yosef parallels in Tanakh. And then at the close of Vayechi, I think we'll probably talk about Shimon and Levi and Shechem and what's going on with the curse in Vayechi. Okay, so Shkach, everybody, thanks for coming and have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always good. Thank you.